going to talk to you more in 30, 40 minutes. Because, but I, all I can say is that I think of the born alcoholic, and I drank, and I'm here, and that pretty well takes care of it. 7 minutes? We're going to do the seventh edition after hear the speaker. I want to say one thing. I went to my first AA meeting in 1946, and I had a choice from that time on whether I drank or not, but I chose to drink for a lot of years after that. So, but it does give us a choice. You're fairly new here. It's the first time in our life we get a choice whether we drink or not, for my part. And I quit for 13 months to prove my wife that I wasn't an alcoholic. And really all I found out by that I was 13 months behind on my drinking. And it damn near killed me to catch up. And then I had to go to hell and take everybody I love to hell with me. And I found this program. And then I'm going to turn it over to Dottie S. To Dottie's store. I'll break her anonymity from North Hollywood. Dottie, it's all yours.
I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi. I'm about as anonymous as a wart on your nose, you know. I have to laugh. So many times when I've been asked to speak out of town, they'll have maybe flyers, and they'll say, Mary M. and George P. and Dottie Shore. Like Mary Ann is my name, you know, the two together. But I really don't care, and the anonymity tradition says it's the level of press, radio, and television, so I can break my anonymity anytime I want to with an AA meeting. And I always have broke my anonymity, not at the level of press, radio, or television, but because I think it's most important that people know that I belong to AA, and I'm glad Dr. Bob and Bill broke their anonymity, or we wouldn't even have this thing off the ground. You know that, don't you? I have to explain to you about my poor hands tonight, because there's a miracle involved in this. I was having trouble with my eyes, and I was getting along pretty well in the daytime, but by evening, it was hard for me to drive home. I do a lot of speaking around my area. So I thought, well, my glasses need changing. So I went to the doctor, and he said, no, there's nothing wrong with your eyes, but the skin on your eyes is hanging and hitting your eyelashes at the end of the day. They call that old age, damn it. And he said, I would suggest that you go to a plastic surgeon and have that excess skin taken off. And so I said, fine. So I found this wonderful plastic surgeon. I went to him. And during the conversation, he asked me if I was on any medication. And I said, just vitamins and a lot of aspirin. And he said, why so much aspirin? And I said, well, I have terrible arthritis in this thumb. And he looked at it and he said, my, it is painful, isn't it? And I said, it sure is. So I went home with a plan to next week to have the operation on my eyes. And he called me the next morning and he said, I've never been able to get your painful thumb out of my mind. I found out later he's a hand reconstruction doctor. Spent 2.5 years in Vietnam repairing hands. And he said, I wish you'd please have an x-ray on that thumb. And so I did. And I had, because I'm extremely right-handed, I had hit that thumb every time I'd open a door or open a jar. And then I'd fallen and hit my thumb and broken my fingernail way down to the quick. And what I had done is shatter the bone in the first joint in my thumb. And if the miracle of this doctor not being a caring doctor and calling me, within less than a month of that time, I'd have lost my thumb. So I went through reconstruction surgery 8 weeks ago yesterday, and I've been in a lot of pain ever since. But because I am so right-handed, I had never used my left hand except to kind of push things around, you know. So I had to start using my left hand, and I sprained and pinched off a muscle or a nerve in his arm. So, I said, what are you trying to teach me, Lord? Patience? Because I sure don't have any. Bobby said tonight on the way over, he's got a lot of patience. He's never used any of it, but he's got a lot of patience. And I think that's what I've got. So really, out of every seeming evil comes some good, and God has given me a miracle because I do have a thumb. It's healing very slowly, but it'll come out of that cast one day, and I am getting along better. So I thank God for that. I had to laugh when Ken was reading tonight, and he said, rarely have we seen a person who has thoroughly followed the path. He left the word fail out. So I've got a new one now, Ken. I heard one not too long ago, it says, thoroughly have we seen a person fail who has rarely followed our path, and I love that one. I started collecting these quite some time ago, and many of you have heard it, but I think those who haven't, I think you'll enjoy. I started listening for these things, and I heard one woman say, animosity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. And someone else said, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop stinking. And then someone said, many of us exclaimed, what an odor, I can't go through with it. a young man was reading, and he said, "What, an order? I can't go through with that." And then I heard someone else read, humbly asked him to restore our shortcomings. The last one was the Butte, and it couldn't be better or more apropos used than tonight. It said, "Our leaders are but twisted servants. They do not govern." Now, of course, you know I love Uncle Bobby, and I don't really mean that. Thank you very, very much for having me back. I come back here about once every year, 2 years, and I feel like I know a lot of you. The ones that are in Reno at that roundup, I feel very sorry for them. They're missing one hell of a talk tonight, but that's all right. But it is a joy, and of course, you know I love Bobby and Belle, and I hope that when we have our meditation tonight, our moment's meditation, that you remember Belle. Belle is in extreme pain, probably with a ruptured disc in her back, so that's just my diagnosis, and she's in extreme pain. So remember Belle when you say your prayers tonight, because she needs a lot of help. So let's talk a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. That's what we're all here for. It's amazing we can all be here to eat dinner tonight and enjoy and have fun and laugh. And yet, most of us, whether alcoholic or non-alcoholic, are afflicted with a killer, terminal, fatal, rotten, stinking, cunning, baffling, powerful disease called alcoholism. It is the longest convalescent time of any disease in the world because it's a lifetime. It's the only disease that affects 10 people around us. Every alcoholic affects 10 people. And, you know, I was often thinking if everyone in this area of Stockton had been diagnosed today as having cancer, and they said, "Now, we can't cure the cancer, but we can arrest it." So if you'll go to a couple of meetings a week from, say, 8:30 to 10, drink some lousy coffee and lie to each other a little bit, we could arrest this cancer. There wouldn't be meeting places in this area for the people who would go. And it wouldn't be too tired, nor too busy, nor too hot, or too cold, or too rainy. If they thought for 1 minute they missed a meeting, that they'd break out in the cancer. What is the matter with us, guys? Why do we treat this disease as such a killer? Either it will take our mind or hopelessly kill us or cripple us. Why do we take it so lightly? Why do we break meeting patterns and get resentful because we don't like the way the leader or the speaker spoke? Or that we're too busy or there's a good television program on? I don't know, except that I think that we're crazy. I think alcoholics are crazy, don't you? Don't you? I think we're crazy. Wonderfully, interestingly, delightfully crazy, but we're crazy. Because we are the only people in the world that can arrest this disease. The medical profession can't help us, and the ministry can't help us. They can help us after we find AA. But we're the only people that can help and do something about our disease, and yet we drag our feet. I think more and more now that the information about alcoholism is getting out, we know so much more about it. We know now that it is hereditary, that it may skip a generation, but if you have alcoholism in your family, and who doesn't these days, that you're predisposed for alcoholism, a great deal like a diabetic. When an alcoholic takes alcohol in any form in the body, it does not burn up, oxidize, go through the kidneys, the bladder, and out in the urine, as it does for the non-alcoholic. It goes directly into the bloodstream, to the spinal fluid, and to the brain, and they know that by testing. And the first part of the brain that's affected is the frontal part. That contains the I care factor, and that's sedated immediately. That's why one drink is too much and 1,000 aren't enough. And so with that information, you've got to know that no matter how you think you've changed, or how spiritual you've gotten, or how much education you have, that this time it'll be different. So once you take that booze down your throat, you're going to be able to tell it what to do. Shows that we're crazy. You cannot say what's going to happen to anything you've swallowed down your gullet. And so we think, well, this time it'll be different. I won't drink so much, I won't do, you know what chapter 3 tells us. And why we fall in that trap, I have no idea, but we do. And that's why so many people go down. The latest result, I'm in the medical profession, and I've been a private counselor in private practice for the past 10 years. I do a lot of research and studying on the disease of alcoholism, or anything that I can get a hold of, and the last one really startled me. It seems like they took 6 babies, brand new babies, that were born of alcoholic fathers. Known alcoholic fathers. And they took 6 babies that were born of non-alcoholic fathers. And they brainwave tested them and found a different brainwave in every one of the babies who had alcoholic fathers. Now you've got to know that this is more than just being upset or having a bad childhood or not having the breaks. These are all contributing factors to our illness. But if we are predisposed physically, the only way we're ever going to get away with this thing is just not to touch alcohol in any form. If that gland in our body either fails to burn up alcohol or never functions, is there, and there's no turning it on, like the pancreas and the diabetic cannot be turned on, then once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And that's fine. And you can go to the Raleigh Clinic, I hear now it's $16,000, or to Six Shadell, and get the aversion treatment, and when you get through there, you're so overwrought that you go across the street and have a drink in order to settle your nerves down, you know. But that isn't going to take care of it, because we're not just a body walking around. So we know that we are allergic, for the want of a better word. We have a bad reaction to something taken into our body. But we still come to meetings and hear this and still go out and drink. Why? My dear God, why do we do that? Because we have the second part of our disease that is so mysterious and very few people talk about it. It's called the obsession of the mind. I talked to a loved one today that said that the idea of smoking pot had been in their mind for about 3 years before they finally failed the program and never spoke or talked to anybody about it. I had the idea in my mind that I was only a little alcoholic. I didn't drink that much, that long, or do those things. I never spoke to anybody about it. And I got drunk and almost died. The AA book says our life must become an open book to one other human being. The secrets will kill us. Why don't we listen? Why don't we read our manual, our medical book, and find out what we can do to make this a comfortable way to get sober? Now, the AA book says the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, some way, someday, we're going to control and enjoy our drinking. The delusion is astonishing, and indeed it is a delusion. Many will pursue it into gates of insanity or death. And when you figure that if you have any sense and you know that your body cannot ever tolerate alcohol again, and yet your mind says that you don't understand that it's going to be different this time, you've got to understand why I call us crazy. Now, I'm not saying we're psychotic. No, we're not. But we're gravely, emotionally ill people. And so many of us will pursue this into the gates of insanity and death. And dear ones, I have pursued alcoholism into the gates of insanity and death. I'm one of those that had to hang on to the very last and almost lost the brass ring. And so that's what I'd like to share with you, because, you know, I don't want you to have to listen to how many times I vomited. It's not nice to talk about vomit right after you've eaten anyhow. But I don't have to be taught how to get sick. I don't have to be taught how to go crazy. For me, it's been very difficult to go to meetings. I try to go to a meeting at least once a week, because otherwise I'm in a meeting talking. You can't give out all the time and not take in. And many nights I'm tired, and I'll think, you better get there. You haven't been there this week for you. Do you know how hard it is for me to go to a meeting and sit for 55 minutes and listen to a drunkalogue? How many cars they wrecked, how many times they got to jail, how many times they vomited, how many times they went crazy? I don't have to listen to that. You don't have to teach me that. But oh, please, please teach me how to survive out there on the bricks with no mind-changing chemical. Teach me how to do it on the natural. Because if you don't do that, you've done nothing for me. I heard a man say one night that he had a belly full of ground glass and his brain was always hemorrhaging. Pretty dramatic, isn't it? But every alcoholic knows what I'm talking about. So you just take my friend alcohol away from me, that finally turned on me, but take that away from me and leave me the same way I was before, so angry that I'm seething, so inferior, so downtrodden, so full of hate, so full of poor me, and you expect me to function out there in that world by just taking alcohol from me? No, no, don't do that to anyone. I'd rather crawl on my hands and knees tonight and get drunk than to ever live dry, because I can't do it. You just can't do it. Now, unfortunately, since I've been around the program, I've seen people who come into the program and, through fear or whatever, never touch another drop of alcohol, but become compulsive overeaters, or compulsive gamblers, or sexually promiscuous, or compulsive spenders, or have migraines, or colitis, or ulcers. I take care of those people all the time. People that come to me sober that never touch another drop and are ripped apart with ulcers. We have to find out what the deeper seated problem is, friends. Alcoholism is but a symptom of a deeper-seated problem. If you don't get down and find out what it is, oh, God, you can stay dry for years. Miserably dry. Now, I don't know about you, but I belong to the cult of the comfortable. I damn near kill myself trying to get comfortable. But I don't want to feel miserable. I love a good time. I love to laugh. I love to be up. And if I can't find that in AA, see, you can't substitute nothing for alcohol. You have to give me something that's worth hanging on to. And many of us, including myself, suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but we can recover if we have the capacity to be honest. And I had to finally go for therapy. Now, when I first came to AA, it was on February 8, 1950. That was 35 years ago. I was only 8 years old when I got here. You understand that? And it was like a men's stag group. They were all men. Very few women. And they wanted to hear a woman speak. And I had this gift of gab that you wouldn't know if I hadn't told you that I have it. And they put me on the circuit when I was 49 days dry. And I spoke from Bakersfield to San Diego and from Santa Barbara to Riverside and any place in between. And I went to 365 meetings that first year. But the trap I fell into was trying to identify with a drinking pattern. And I'd hear fifths a day and sanitariums and jails and 502s and 86s. I heard more numbers than I ever heard before in my life, didn't know what they meant. And immediately thought to myself, my God, I scared myself into this thing. Now, granted, I only weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. My lips were split and bleeding at the corners. And I had these bumps under my neck they called vitamin deficiency bumps. I couldn't drive my car. I was unemployable. I couldn't buy a dress for myself or arrange my hair. But there wasn't anything wrong with me, you understand. And I couldn't identify with the drinking pattern. And I think that's too bad. That's why I don't like drunkologues. Oh, we have to identify. But talk about the thinking, the stinking thinking that leads to drinking. And I can identify with everybody's thinking. Because I don't care if you're black, white, young, or old, female, or male. You and I can sit down and within a very few minutes just talk up a storm. Now, staying with Bobby and Belle, we sat there and talked today, and Ken came over, and we all talked, and then Ken and Bobby left, and Belle and I kept on talking, and pretty soon they came back. We hadn't even moved from the chair, sitting there drinking coffee. And I can do that with any of you tonight. We talked the language of the heart. So identify with my thinking. Tell me what to do about my emotions that are torn apart. Tell me what's wrong with me. Tell me that I grew up physically and I grew up mentally because nobody put their hand on me and hold my head down and I was forced to go to school. So I grew physically and mentally, but emotionally I'm only 3 years old. My God, I'm 3 years old trying to take care of two kids and a husband and be president of the PTA, for God's sake. Tell me why. What happened to me? Why did I get emotionally stunted? Tell me that I'm a child-dominated woman, that I don't react like a woman. Help me grow up emotionally so I can square my shoulders and take my rightful role in society. So many people aren't willing to work at it. I think, oh, Dottie, you get into so much analysis. All right, forgive me. Stay miserable. I don't give a damn. Go on, just say, how are you today? Well, I'm sober. Jesus, I don't want to be like that. I want to be, you promised me sobriety, peace of mind, and a quiet heart if I was willing to fulfill the conditions. And when I finally had to go for therapy because I was very sick, I started to get well. Bob, would you get me a drink of water, please, honey? I went when I was 5 years sober. I went when I was 15 years sober. I was very, very emotionally crippled. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, Bill said one time in one of the grapevines that if you have a broken leg, don't read the 12 steps over it. Take it to a doctor. And to be friendly to your friends. If you suffer from emotional disorders, take it to a therapist. Granted, I hope the person's in AA because we alcoholics are bodily and mentally different than our fellows. And I hope you'll do that. You don't have to. Nothing I say has to be done. I'm just trying to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. Well, finding out for myself that I was not an alcoholic, I thought, thank you, Bob. I stayed with you people because I loved you so much. I'm an extrovert by nature. You didn't know that either, did you? But I had become totally introverted. I stayed in my apartment. I was afraid to go out. I wouldn't go any place unless my husband took me. I was in a prison of my own making. And when I attended my first AA meeting and walked through the doors of North Hollywood, nobody said to me, my God, put some weight on. Turn your makeup down. How much money do you have? What kind of a car are you driving? You know, you have to qualify for any other group You have to be a failure for ours, and I qualified. So they didn't say any of those things to me. They said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, yes, I do. And the lady put her arms around me, and she said, welcome, honey. You're home. How many times have people said that to people? And they accepted me totally as I was for the first time in my life. Not as I would be, could be, or should be, but as I was that night, a total basket case. Now, I pursued it to the gates of insanity because I was in blackouts and hallucinations when I came to you. My capacity was disgustingly small. A half a pint and a few beers was my total capacity. And so when I tried to withdraw, I'd have hallucinations. I'd see foam coming out of the hardwood floors, and I'd see people looking in the window with their hands up like this, watching me, and I'd pull the window seats down and take a drink and pull them back up. I was a pretty tired drunk when I got here, you better believe. But that's hallucinations, the first sign of brain damage. And I can tell you that what happened to my brain, I had a phenomenal gift at one time called total recall memory. And I could read a page and give it back to you, common period. I can't do that. I do have a remarkable photographic memory, but not a total recall. And physically, I was to be almost 5 years sober before I found out what was wrong with my stomach. I would have periodic horrible bouts with chronic diarrhea, colitis, to the extent that they thought I was going to have a colostomy at one time. And finally, by the grace of God, I was presented to a man that was an endocrinologist and a doctor of preventative medicine, and he found out that I don't have digestive enzymes working in my stomach. So he put me on digestive enzymes that you can buy in a health food store. And I take one after every meal, and I've been fine ever since. So I'm very lucky. But I could have done a lot of damage, and my capacity for alcoholism was only about 4.5 years. I would say I was alcoholic from the very beginning, but it was a long time periodic. I never drank a beer on a hot afternoon or a cocktail before dinner. I don't know what the hell kind of drinking that is, but I always said, let's get drunk, let's get smashed. I always wanted to get from here over here. And so the last 4.5 years, however, was chronic. Hide the bottle, cry, stay home, gutless kind of alcoholism. And it was terrible, and it almost took my mind. Now when I get here and I'm busy then being a circuit speaker and you people love me so much, and everything's wonderful, I memorize the 12 steps and I can quote them to you tonight, and I can quote you chapter 5 and chapter 3, and I can quote the traditions, and I didn't know the head knowledge alone is not enough. That's what the book says. I knew it all. You want to know about AA? Just ask me. If you don't, I'll tell you about it anyhow. I was a walking encyclopedia. And I quoted the book, and everybody was impressed with me, and they started telling me how wonderful I was. And I started to agree with them. And that's where I fell. Ego is edging God out, E-G-O. You can get drunk faster on ego than you can the first drink. And I just jumped from the inferiority side of my personality and jumped over onto the superiority side of my personality and fell in love with my own crest. I thought I was the greatest thing that anybody ever had. And so it wasn't to last too long. I got my first birthday cake on February 8th, 1951. I guess I thought I'd graduated that night. I got more presents than I ever got, named a birthday. People told me how great I was. My family was in the front row. Oh, my God, it was just wonderful. And then the postnatal blues set in. Now I got another year to go for my big night, and I'm tired. So I did a lot of crazy things. I broke my meeting pattern. I started going on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then finally I started going just on Thursdays. I would be very unhappy if I went to make a talk and there wasn't a big crowd. And so I started screening the places. If they asked me to speak, I'd say, how big is the group? It was a big group I went. It was a small group. I sent one of my babies. And you've got to realize who you're talking to. You know, old timer, 16 months. I didn't know this was happening. I had no idea. I was mentally drunk long before I got drunk. I had never taken inventory. I thought my deep-seated problem was just drinking, and I hadn't drank. I had no problem staying away from booze. My sponsor said to me that she'd worked with many people and I had her totally buffaloed, because she was baffled by me. She said to me early on, you haven't had an obsession to drink, have you, since you got here? And I said, no. And I thought I was telling the truth, because I didn't have any trouble staying out of a liquor store or keep my hand off a glass. But I didn't know that little voice back here that said, Dottie, you're not like those people. But not now. When did you get your first cake? And besides, you're such a helper. You're helping these poor sick people. That makes you sick. And when you get your thinking sitting around, maybe even drink again. Not now, but one day. I never told anybody. I kept that my secret. And secrets will kill us. And so things got worse after my first birthday. The newness of AA wore off. I had no foundation. I was on shallow ground. I remind myself of the two men in the Bible. He talked about the wise man who built his house on a rock. And the storm came and slashed at the house, but the house was on a good foundation, so it stood. Then there's a foolish man who built his house on sand. And when the rain came, it hit that sand, and the house fell, and great was the fall of the house, because the foundation was no good. And my foundation was on shifting sands. So the first thing that came along, first storm that hit me, you see, I had to carry me away. I had no way. I had 12 steps that I could recite, preach, memorize, and teach, but didn't know how to apply. So on June 11th, 1951, I took 3 drinks and almost lost my life. I remember the first one when I burned my throat. I don't remember anything from that time on. By the grace of God, my husband got home that morning, found me on the floor, kicking and beating my heels, so I almost shattered the bones in my feet. I dry heaved my buccal blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood. I wrenched my buccal blood vessels in my eyes. And when he tried to get me across the floor and put me on the couch, I went totally limp. Now, in terror, and don't forget, in 1951, there was no hospitals that would touch us, no insurance that would cover the disease of alcoholism. You take someone to the emergency room and DTs, and they tell you to get that drunken bum out of their waiting room. But because I was in such bad shape, and my husband thought I was dying, he just ran 2 blocks from my house to a medical center. There were 7 doors along the sidewalk. He came to the first office that was available, and the office was full of people. He went to the receptionist, and she was busy. So he went past her into the doctor's examining room, grabbed the doctor by the arms and said, "My wife's been sober 16 months. She's drinking and she's dying. For God's sake, come." And loved ones, the first of many miracles that was set forth for me. Because the doctor didn't say, "Get the rescue squad," or "My God, another drunk," or "Do you have hospitalization?" or "Who recommended you? Fill out this form." Any of those things, and I wouldn't be here talking to you tonight. He just said later, "He never saw anyone so terrorized." And without a word, he picked up his black bag and ran 2 blocks back to my home. And the reason he did, friends, is because he was an alcoholic. Now, that's a miracle. It's not a coincidence. That's a complicated way of spelling God. And when he put the stethoscope on my chest, he said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Shore, there's no heartbeat, no pulse, and no respiration." So on June 11th, 1951, Dottie Shore died of a killer, terminal, filthy, rotten, cunning, baffling, powerful disease called alcoholism. And the only reason I'm here tonight, loved ones, is by the grace of God. Now, we use that expression a lot. I never knew what it meant. And one day I read a definition. The grace of God is a free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift. And when I was on the floor bleeding and dying, I was granted the grace of God and the gift of sobriety. When the doctor... when my husband got hysterical, the doctor said later he didn't think it would do any good. Well, that's good. Didn't think it would do any good, but he took a long needle out of his bag and shot me directly in the chest cavity and gave me artificial resuscitation. And truly, by the grace of God, my heart started beating. Now, if you take it back, say Al had been a minute late coming home, or the doctor had waited 2 minutes, they could have brought my heart back beating, but my brain would have been damaged beyond repair. So I have always believed, and I will always believe, I think, to the day I die, that God had something he wanted me to do. And 2 days later in the doctor's office, when he took me by the arms and shook me and said, "You hear me, and you hear me good. You're as good as anybody I've ever examined, and if you ever drink again, you will surely die." And I thought, oh, why didn't he just let me go? I had my out. Why didn't he let me go? And then the second thought, there must be something God wants me to do. And so 2 days out of my last drunk, I made a commitment, and I said, "Lord, I don't understand why you left me, but I vow to you that I'll never be too tired nor too busy to answer a call for anyone. Use me all the days of my life till I'm all used up for your glory." Now, you've got to be careful when you pray that prayer, because he's going to do it. He's going to use it. The harvest is plentiful, and the workers are very few. But with using you, he'll give you the greatest joy to be used. And so since that day, I have spoken almost all over the United States and into Canada. I'm booked way up until December. Wonderful. I'm not complaining. I'm not bragging. I'm telling you what God has done for me. I used to be very lonely. I used to think that I was a big blob taking up space, that I couldn't do anything. And once I put my foot on the first step of the 12 steps, my life turned around 180 degrees. And I thank God for that. 1 month from today, God willing, and I know He is, I will be 34 years sober on this program. Now, that's a miracle, friends. I have never, until that time, done or completed anything successfully. How many times, my God, have I started a knit sweater 40 days before Easter for my kids? And I'd knit until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and then never finish them. Or start to clean my house, wash the windows, clean the carpet, do everything, and then quit in the middle. Never complete it. Always a great enthusiast. Start to clean out dresser drawers or cupboards, anything, and go at it and then peter out before I was through. And I have one day at a time, with the help of God and His grace, completed the 24 hours it took to do the things that were necessary to almost complete 34 years of sobriety as of now. You've got to know this program is magical, mystical, miraculous. Now, if it was just staying away from booze, it's a deal. That's very important, don't mistake me. But like I said, my God, help me to learn how to live out there in the bricks with those people and inside of my own skin. I was always uncomfortable in my own skin. And when I have booze, I feel more comfortable. And pretty soon, booze let me down. So you've got to do something better than that for me. And you did. And I think the thing that you helped me do was to find out what my missing link was. And I went to 365 meetings that year. I had more AA babies at North Hollywood than anybody else. I made talks. I poured coffee. I greeted people at the door. I did everything that I knew how to do, and yet I got drunk. So when I came back to AA, by the grace of God, after the doctor had given me a shot in the chest cavity and artificial resuscitation, I decided to find out what my missing link was. And I went around asking everybody. And I finally found it. I thought all the time I had a twofold disease. An allergy to the body, coupled with a depression of the mind. And I was to find out I had a spiritual illness. Now those are AA words, and we're not talking about religion. But we are a three-faceted human being. We are body, mind, and spirit. And we are sick in three ways. That's why AA will help us where no other group can, because AA attacks it on the three levels, spiritually, physically, and emotionally. And in the book says no human power can relieve alcoholism, but God can and will if sought. And it tells me a strange thing. It says, as I get well spiritually, the physical and the emotional will follow. And I think to myself, how can I get well spiritually when I'm still physically sick? And I had to find that out. Well, they know now that in 72 hours they can test you, your analysis and blood count, and you won't have any alcohol in your system. But it takes a year to a year and a half to get it out of the head. That's why you'll see people get their first cake and say, what a wonderful year, and the monkey's off my back, and everything's great. Then the next year they get their second cake and they'll say, God, that was a bitch of a year. Because they're starting to sober up and their nerves are starting to scream and they haven't any sedative, no mind thinking chemical. It takes that long to get it out of your head. That's why I say it's the longest convalescent time that you ever know. And so you have to get well spiritually, which means an honest and upright way of life. Religion is a man-made way of worshiping God, and religion has screwed up more people than anybody I know, including me. I'm talking about a walk with the Lord, an honest and upright way of life. Now, if you think that you can stay sober and lie and cheat and fornicate and criticize and remain angry and vindictive and stay sober, well, if you do, you know, tell me about it and we'll write a new chapter in the book for you. It's impossible. You can't mix the two. We must grow spiritually, or an honest and upright way of life, if we indeed expect a power greater than ourselves to come in and do anything for us. And without that, we can't make it. No human power can relieve alcoholism. I know that because I'll give you some of my sobriety. I walk around and give you little hunks, and Bobby's been a long time. And several people give you little hunks of it. If a person could do it, God, I'd do it. I'd alleviate your pain in a minute. I can help you. I can share my experience, strength, and hope. But I cannot give you the gift of sobriety. It comes strictly from God alone. So don't get your back up about God and say, well, I don't like the spiritual part of the program. It's a spiritual program. There's no spiritual part. And I lacked that because I've had a very, very bad experience in religion. I was born and raised in the Roman Catholic Church, and I'm not talking against the church now. I'm talking about a practicing alcoholic priest who literally terrorized me, scared me half to death. I ran away and got married when I was 16 to get away from my mother and my bad home life, and was pregnant 2 months later, and the marriage didn't last, and I divorced, and the parish priest told me that I must never marry again, because if I ever did, I'd be living in adultery, and that child would be illegitimate, And I told him I was going to get married again, and he pointed his finger at me and said, "You're excommunicated as of right now." And if God had told me that, it couldn't have been any more valid. So for 19 years, I wanted to face this earth like a lost soul. Denied the sacraments of the church. I was beyond the pale. So Al and I get married. He adopts my first daughter, and my second daughter, Sandy, is sick for the first 7 years of her life. And every time she got sick, God was going to kill her and punish me. Now I come to AA, and you tell me to turn my life and my will over to that crackpot up on that cloud? Couldn't do it. Yet if I don't do it, I'm going to get drunk. And if I get drunk, I'm going to die. You talk about being between a rock and a hard place. So I went to my sponsor, and I told her, I said, "I can't work the third step." And she said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because I'm afraid of God." And she said, "Well, honey, tell me about him." So I started to tell her, and she said, "Oh, my God, let's run. I'm afraid of him, too." She said, "You're going to have to find a new God." Well, you know, that's about as easy as holding your breath for 45 minutes. So I went over to North Hollywood, the only place I ever knew, and I said, "How do you believe in God?" And this guy says, "You mean the old pal Joe?" I said, "Oh, my God, that's blasphemy." So I left him quick. I asked the other girl, "How do you believe in God? You mean old age tea?" "Oh, my God, that's wrong, too." Somebody else said, "The old man upstairs?" And I thought, "Oh, God, you know, this is terrible. You're going to really put us all in hell." And there's a man sitting over there, you know, the old timer that just sits there and listens to all this drivel. And he called me over and he said, "Daddy, you're going to drive yourself crazy." He said, "If you want to find God, will you do as I tell you?" And I said, "I'll do anything if you'll help me." He said, "All right, just pray this prayer without any other for a week. You say, 'God, reveal yourself to me as you really are,' and start looking." Oh, my dear ones, without exaggeration, I prayed that prayer 100 times a day. And in 1 week's time, he got off that silly cloud, threw away the books, the beard, and became my daddy God. And from that day to this, I wish I had time to tell you the things that happened in a week. I started looking, and I saw miracle after miracle after miracle. And I believe when you pray that prayer, "God, reveal yourself to me as you really are," he's just waiting for that invitation to come in. And he may not reveal himself to you as a daddy God. He reveals himself to you as he is to you. Since then, I've become a Christian. I've gone back to the church of my choice, and I read the scriptures. I believe in Jesus. I'm not trying to proselyte. I'm just saying that I came for sobriety. You gave me back God. You gave me back a Savior named Jesus, and I thank you for that. I'm at peace. He loves me so much that there's nothing he won't do for me if I will fulfill my conditions. If I'll be about my Father's business and quit minding his business, he'll do everything for me that's needed. Now, too many times for my liking, he tells me no. I don't like that. Sometimes he says later. I don't like that either. All the yes answers I can take. But you know, just recently I realized that when the God says no, that he has a perfectly good reason. It's not because he's an old crackpot or he wants to be mean to me. And I was praying very diligently for something here recently and thinking, you know, this is the way my mind is going. I've been so good, Lord, and I've answered your calls and I've done all the speaking you want me to do and I've practically worn myself out. See, I'm selling this bill of goods to God. He doesn't buy it, but I'm selling it. Please let me have this. And nothing happened. About 3 weeks down the road, you know what I said? Thank God I didn't get that. Because 3 weeks down the road, I looked at it and thought, holy cow, how could I have ever thought that would have been good for me? He knows tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow. And I no longer do that. I ask for God's will for me. Only God's will. And the power to carry it out. Because my two enemies are alcohol and my will. My two destructions. I used to think it was my mother and my husband and the weather and finances. No, they never destroyed me. Alcohol and my will are my destruction. So I've turned the alcoholism problem over to God. I've turned my will over to the best that I know. I said, I'll take it back. But for the first time in many years, I have what is called the peace that passes all understanding. Things aren't like I want out there. My thumb still hurts me. But in here, I have the thing that he promised me. Jesus said, my peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, but my peace, the peace that passes understanding. And I have it. Even with a painful hand, I have it. You've got to know that his word is true. And I thank God for that. You know, 4 years ago, I was asked to speak in Pasadena at what they call the old timers meeting. I wish they'd call it the long timers meeting. I don't like that word, old timers. And I asked the man, I said, what's the thing? And he said, just kind of reminisce what's happened in 30 years. And I went home, my loved ones, I had this simple. Because I started thinking about the people I worked with that came in when I came in. Where are they? Where are the new girls that came in that I 12-stepped? Where are they? Where is the long-timer in AA? They're gone. And I could count on the finger of one hand the people I knew. And I said, why me? My God, why me? Why am I sober and all those beautiful, talented people? Why are they gone? Because they continued on fighting. And when I got out of that last drunk, I surrendered. I threw in the towel, I hung up the boxing gloves, and I got out of the ring. And I surrendered, and I won. Now, in the time I've been sober, I have lost two sisters to the disease of alcoholism. One was 39 when she died, and the other died 3 years ago at the age of 58. They didn't have 2 days back-to-back of sobriety. You know how many people will never, ever come through the door of any Alano club? They'll die without ever hearing the word. You know how many people will come in here and stay a while and go out and never have a chance to come back? Do you know how many funerals I've gone to, dear ones, in 34 years? Come on. Heartbreaking. Beautiful women. I've seen 3 people sentenced to Patton Street Hospital. And it's not necessary. Don't talk drunkologue. My God. Share in a general way what you used to be like, what happened, and what you're like now. But tell them what they can do when their child is an addict, alcoholic like mine, who snatches their life away and you don't know if she's ever going to make it, she's going to live or die. And then tell me what happens when your grandson becomes an addict, alcoholic, and you don't know what's going to happen to him. And tell me when your sister dies and you try to help her, and the last words she says on this physical plane was, for God's sake, get me a drink. Last words she ever said. And then your husband goes into business with an alcoholic partner and you beg him not to. And he says, anytime you see somebody drink, you think they're an alcoholic. And I said, it takes one to know one. And 9 months later, we go down the drain. We lose our house, we lose our car, we lose everything. Tell me how to get through that, would you please? And you did. Tell me what happens when your mother dies and you have to go home for a funeral. Tell me when your younger sister said, daughter, you have God as a crutch and alcohol is my crutch and I have my crutch. How do you go through those things? Because if you don't help me go through that, you ain't worth nothing. Don't tell me how to stop drinking or how to learn how to vomit, because I don't need that. And I think that if we would take care of the things that are every day, when you're out of a job or you go through a divorce, I went through a divorce after 33 years of marriage. Heartbreaking. Help me through that. And you did. Practice these principles in all your affairs, friends. And it isn't stay away from booze. That will be the easiest thing you have ever done. But teach me how to contain my thinking, how to change my sinking thinking, how to find the God of my understanding, how to get out of my selfish, self-centered self and help somebody else. And then you're going to have something. And so I can say, why me? And you can say, why me? Why am I an alcoholic? And when I say, why me? Why am I sober? I can look back and say, because I was willing to go to any length to fulfill the conditions. And I'm not bragging. I did it because I had no other choice. I became willing as only the dying can. Now it's up to you if you want to keep going in and out, if you want to lose your mind, if you want to take the drink that'll wipe away your head. But please, dear ones, remember this. Everybody in this room that's an alcoholic has another drunk in them. We all have one more drunk in us. But some of you don't have sober enough time left. When you came to AA, you were presented with some invisible pieces of paper. My idea only. You may have 1, 5, 10, I don't know how many. It's called sobering up time. And I punched my last return ticket. I don't have any more. And you don't know when you go out again whether you'll ever get back again. And so if you've gone out and drank, forget it. Just get on your knees tonight and say, thank God I'm back. A lovely little girl was picking up the salt and shakers and she said, I'm only 2 months sober. Only 2 months? My God, that's better than not having 2 days back to back.
Not the length of time that counts. Quantity is not as much as quality. But please remember, we have a killer disease. And we can have the best way of life that was ever presented to man on the face of the earth with this AA program. Now I'm going to tell you something that is kind of personal, but I think you have to hear it because it changed my life.
My mother was a very dominating woman, matriarch. My dad was a very quiet man. And everything that happened in my life that was no good was that damn father's fault. And so if I couldn't have a new blouse or I couldn't have a new dress or I couldn't go someplace, it's that damn father's fault. So somewhere along the line, I just wiped my father out. And I didn't hate him. I didn't love him. He just wasn't there. And as I got married, we used to go back to Reno, my hometown, to visit my mother and, quote, father, but it was just to kiss daddy and see mother. And so that's the way it was. In 1969, my mother died, and I went up to Reno to help my father. And my father decided to give up his house and go down to Northern California to spend the time with my sister. And I was very relieved. I thought, thank God. My sister was becoming fashionably an alcoholic, and I would try to go see my dad, but she had her needle out. You know, drunks don't like AA members. And so I thought, you know, who needs this? So I'd send him money, call him on the phone, but thought nothing of it. He was just a faceless figure. And a year and a half or more, 2 years ago, I guess, my sister died. And my brother-in-law said, Dottie, I don't want to come home and feed your father and take care of him. And he deserves a medal for having done it as long. He said, let's put him in a retirement home and give him the choice to come to Southern California or Northern California. Again, we gave my dad the choice. He chose Northern California because he's a member of the senior citizens. And again, I wiped my brow with, whew, thank God, I don't have to worry about this old man. Like I said, I didn't hate him. I didn't love him. I didn't have any feeling. Well, about a year, I guess a year ago, this last March, March the 5th, a year ago, the phone rang and my brother-in-law said, Dottie, I'm going to get married again and I'm leaving the area. You're going to have to come and get your father. Well, I went into such a snit, I can't tell you. I thought, how can I do this? How can I travel all over speaking, hold down job as a counselor, go out all the time, and take care of this 90-year-old man? And I was just fighting. And when I fight, I get a knot here in the pit of my gut. It's just like a rat feeding me. And I know that I'm fighting. And so finally, just walking and praying and riling at God, how could you do this to me? The thought came to my mind, honor thy father and thy mother. Now, it doesn't mean like or love. Honor means you'll not see them in want. And my father was 90 years old and in want. So I did the thing finally that I always do when I get beat. I let go and I let God and I said, I don't understand, Lord, how this is your will. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And the load went off my shoulders. And I got a stretcher chair and a wheelchair and I flew up by TSA up to Sunnyvale, landed in San Jose, picked up my dad, brought him back down to Southern California. He wasn't with me 4 days, so I fell totally in love with him. A more delightful, precious man. I had to work real hard on not resenting my mother for robbing me all those years of my dad. He was an absolute joy. Because he was very old, he couldn't take the move as much as I'd like to have had it, and he got pneumonia, and I had to put him in the hospital. And while he was in the hospital, the man next to him died. And I knew it because I called that night, and they told me they'd moved my father. So I go tearing over to the hospital, and I said, Daddy, did that upset you? And he said, Dottie, of course not. It was his time. His time had come. I thought, yikes, he's got built-in AA, and I didn't even know it. So he gets well, and I bring him home to another place called a retirement residential care. And he wanted to go and see things, and he had gout very badly in his hand. And the doctor told me there may be a possibility of having to amputate his hand. They had neglected it up there. They hadn't taken care of it. But he also had some in his feet. And so I told him, I said, Dad, if you can swallow your pride, I'm going to put you in a wheelchair, and I'll take you all over down here. And he thought for a minute, and he said, well, let's go for it. So I took him to Marineland, and I took him to African Safari. We took him to Benihana's. He'd love to see the Japs cut those meat up and throw those knives. He just had an absolute ball. Never saw anybody. It was more like a child. And just loving, and kept telling me how much he loved me, and telling me wonderful things that happened in my childhood that I had totally neurotically moved out. I can tell you every bad thing that ever happened. But the joy, I never could remember that. Can you? No, I wouldn't tell you all the bad. So anyhow, it went on. And on the 18th of May last year, my daddy was 91 years old. And we had a big birthday party for him. And I am a great-grandmother. And please tell me when I get through, I don't look old enough to be a great-grandmother. But I love it. And so my great-grandson was his great-great-grandson. That's 5 generations. And the LA Times came out and took a picture of us and put it in the paper. And my dad, he was so proud and so pleased. And the baby loved him, and we had streamers and helium balloons and had a regular party for him, had a delightful time. And in June, the Palm Springs Roundup came along, and it was the only time I was going to leave him. And I told my daughter and my granddaughter to go on Saturday to take Dad to lunch, and on Sunday to take him to lunch. I'd be back Sunday night. So I went to the room to see him, and he said to me, when I walked in, I was all dressed up, and usually I went over slacks on, and he said, "Damn, but you're a fine-looking woman." Can you imagine your daddy saying that to you? And he said, "If you weren't my daughter, I'd fall in love with you." And so he said, "Now don't get too sunburned, and I'll see you Sunday night." And he threw me a big kiss, and I can see him sitting in that chair, and I left. And I called him Saturday morning and Saturday night. Saturday night, he said he was a little tired, but he was going to go to bed early, so he'd be ready to go to lunch on Sunday with Sandy. And at 7:45 Sunday morning, the phone rang. And my daughter said, "Mama, Grandpa's gone. And he died very quickly. Just left like a puff of smoke. I had him with me 2 months and 18 days, and he changed my life." I said, "No, Lord, no." Since that day, I have a sign in my kitchen, and it says, "Yes, Lord." Whenever anything happens now with my hand or anything else, I don't say, "Oh, no." I say, "Yes, Lord, I don't understand, but I know you're going to work it out for good." And so if I've learned anything in the past year, or indeed in 34 years, it's to hold me in good stead, I think, one day at a time for the rest of my life, is to say this sentence, "Lord, I don't understand how this can be your will. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. Thank you very much."